they occupy 10.1% of hospital beds, and that's 1,244 fewer people in the hospital than a week ago. 4,923 new cases were reported on August 20th. There were 29,880 molecular tests reported on August 19th. That made the positivity rate 14.1%. 10,793 Texans have died as of August 20th. 234 more deaths than the day before, and 1,504 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate crude is trading today at $41.94, and that is down 88 cents. Here's one additional economic-related number for you. From the Texas Tribune, Texas's July unemployment rate dropped slightly to 8%. In July, 8% of Texans were jobless, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported Friday. A sign that Texas's economy is still languishing as the coronavirus pandemic rages across the country. That is up from a near-record low of 3.5% of jobless Texans in July 2019 and down from June when 8.4% of Texans were unemployed. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The Trump administration blocked the Food and Drug Administration from regulating a broad swath of laboratory tests, including those used to detect the coronavirus. Fears that flu season could collide with the coronavirus pandemic and create an unprecedented threat to public health are prompting officials to expand access to flu shots and tighten vaccination requirements for students. Southern states have begun to turn the tide on the pandemic, CDC Director Robert Redfield said Thursday. But he warned that Middle America is stuck right now, and that infection numbers are still too high in states such as Nebraska and Oklahoma. Health officials in Collin County, Texas, announced that they have no confidence in the state's coronavirus tracking data after coding issues led to a backlog that made it look like cases were surging. A new lawsuit led by the Service Employees International Union alleges that the nation's largest healthcare chain failed to protect employees, patients, and the community against COVID-19. As students return to U.S. campuses, at least 15 states are reporting positive coronavirus cases at universities. Meanwhile, the White House has officially designated teachers as essential workers. Just weeks after many European countries opened their borders to travelers within the continent, some are closing again, seemingly undermining efforts to salvage the continent's vital summer tourism economy. Now we'll move on to readings of some articles. From Marfa Public Radio today. For weeks, Midland Nursing Home and Health Department kept quiet about coronavirus outbreak, by Mitch Borden. For 2 weeks, as the coronavirus spread among residents and staff at a Midland nursing home, the city's health department and the facility didn't publicly acknowledge the outbreak. While the first reported coronavirus case at the facility happened on August 3rd, it wasn't until 14 days later that Midland's health department announced the viral cluster at Ashton Medical Lodge, where almost 60 residents and staff have now tested positive for the coronavirus. Since August 3rd, 40 residents at Midland's Ashton Medical Lodge, which makes up to 30% of those who were living at the nursing home when the outbreak began, have tested positive for the coronavirus, along with 18 staff members. Days after the first reported case, residents diagnosed with COVID-19 at the facility were transferred to sister facilities across Texas. At least six people have died so far as a result of the outbreak. City officials announced the existence of the hotspot on Monday, August 17th. The reason the outbreak wasn't identified earlier was the Midland Health Department changed how it reports coronavirus clusters, according to the director of the health department, Whitney Craig. As coronavirus outbreaks at nursing facilities became a problem across the nation, Craig said her department began recommending facilities and businesses remain transparent and make these announcements concerning coronavirus cases to the public. She said Midland's health department specifically didn't have the power to force nursing homes to announce coronavirus cases. But Craig said once it became clear that Ashton Medical Lodge and its parent company, Foursquare Healthcare, had no intention of publicly announcing the recent outbreak, she decided to release the information. In a statement to Marfa Public Radio, Jordan Moeller, an administrator at Ashton Medical Lodge, said the facility immediately reported all of its COVID-19 cases to Midland County and gave regular updates to its residents' family members. In accordance with state protocols, we immediately report all COVID cases to the county health officer and update the primary contact for each of our residents during our daily family calls, said Moeller in a prepared statement. We will continue to work to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. Moeller said the nursing home is being deep cleaned and is limiting the amount of contact residents have with employees to limit the spread of the virus. Ashton Medical Lodge has also been transferring all positive COVID-19 patients to Midland Medical Lodge and to another Foursquare Healthcare facility in Dallas. Patients are being transferred to these other long-term care facilities, Moeller explained, because both have advanced infectious disease training and are equipped to provide specialized care to COVID-19 patients. The reason the nearby Midland Medical Lodge has been able to provide specialized care to at least 13 of the coronavirus patients from Ashton Medical Lodge is the facility had its own significant outbreak of COVID-19 earlier this year. In April and May, the coronavirus ran rampant through Midland Medical Lodge. Over 60 people connected to the facility tested positive for the coronavirus, and at least 10 people died as a result of the outbreak. The state eventually sent a team of specialists to help get the spread of the virus under control at the care facility. By the time Ashton Medical Lodge residents were transferred to the nursing home, there was only one resident on site diagnosed with COVID-19. Midland's health department has reported at least three new COVID-19-related deaths at Midland Medical Lodge since Ashton Medical Lodge patients were transferred to the nursing home for treatment. Officials, however, did not specify if the patients were originally from Ashton Medical Lodge. Coming up in just a moment, I'll read another article related to nursing homes and an effort to stop COVID-19 in those places. Before I read that, I have one other note from Marfa Public Radio. Big Bend region to see additional rounds of mobile testing next week. Communities around the Big Bend will receive new rounds of coronavirus testing in the next week. The announcement of state-run mobile tests in Alpine, Marfa, and Presidio comes shortly after Presidio County officials announced several new cases and the county's fourth COVID-19-related death. Testing begins next week with 2 weeks of testing in the city of Presidio, an area that state testing teams last visited in June. Local officials have been working to get additional screenings in the border town, whose population is largely Hispanic, less likely to be insured, and older. Across the state, communities of color have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Texas has so far had nearly 10,000 coronavirus-related deaths. 53% are Hispanic Texans, who only account for 40% of the state's population. Testing in the Big Bend will continue on Wednesday at the Marfa Visitor Center, followed by 2 days of testing in Alpine. Testing will run from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at each site or until testing capacity is reached. No appointment is needed, but personal identification is required to receive a test. Testing will be held on Monday, August 24th, at the City of Presidio Fire Station in Presidio. Tuesday, August 25th, at the City of Presidio Fire Station in Presidio. Wednesday, August 26th, at the Marfa Visitor Center in Marfa. Thursday, August 27th, at the Alpine Fire Station in Alpine. Friday, August 28th, at the Alpine Fire Station in Alpine. Once again, the testing hours are 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at each site or until testing capacity is reached. Now to this New York Times article. An unprecedented effort to stop the coronavirus in nursing homes. Researchers are testing an experimental drug to halt sudden outbreaks, the trial may bring a new type of treatment for the virus. The coronavirus crept into Heartland Health Care Center, a nursing home in Moline, Illinois, on the last day of July when a member of the nursing staff tested positive. It was an ominous sign. The virus can spread through a nursing home in a flash. Older people, who are often sick and frail and need regular hands-on attention, are uniquely susceptible. Staff members who care for residents are at high risk of infection and of unintentionally spreading the virus. Although nursing home residents make up just 1.2% of the United States population, they account for about 40% of COVID-19 deaths. But this time, the nursing home was not defenseless. Heartland was the first facility to participate in a large clinical trial of a drug that might protect residents from the infection in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Drug companies and the federal government often avoid testing drugs in older people, even if they are the ones who need treatment most. The elderly may have a range of complicating conditions that make it difficult to tell if the drug is working, and nursing home and extended care facilities are governed by a raft of complex regulations regarding privacy and access. Experts say the new research, sponsored by Eli Lilly and the National Institutes of Health, is among the first large clinical trials to involve nursing home residents, and the scientists are delighted. "These patients are so underserved," said Dr. Rebecca Boxer, medical director of clinical trials at the Kaiser Permanente Institute for Health Research in Colorado. "They do not get access to innovative new drugs and trials." The experimental drug is a monoclonal antibody, an artificially synthesized version of coronavirus antibodies produced by the body. In this case, the antibody was cloned from those found in the blood of a Seattle man, one of the first patients to survive COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. Monoclonal antibodies are one of the great hopes in the war on the coronavirus. They already serve as the basis for effective treatments for arthritis, cancer, lupus, even Ebola. They are difficult to manufacture, however, and expensive. Despite the obstacles, two companies, Regeneron and Eli Lilly, have forged ahead with clinical trials. The trial in nursing homes is pivotal to Eli Lilly's effort to determine whether its version can stop the coronavirus. "Some people ask, if we have a vaccine, why do this?" said Dr. Myron Cohen, a University of North Carolina researcher who proposed the trial. "But a vaccine will take a month to produce antibodies, and some populations need a more emergent intervention. But it is not easy to do a trial in nursing homes, because the residents cannot be expected to travel to a clinic for an infusion and subsequent testing and monitoring. The clinical trial must come to them." Eli Lilly's researchers are watching facilities in which a single case of COVID-19 appears after having no active cases for at least 14 days. Once the case is reported, a sort of medical SWAT team scrambles to the facility as quickly as possible. A nursing supervisor at Heartland called Eli Lilly as soon as the home learned of the employee's positive test. The team wasted no time getting to the facility. The next day, medical personnel pulled up in two vehicles. One was a moving truck carrying infusion chairs, poles for intravenous infusions, bedside tables, and privacy screens. The other was an RV with an interior retrofitted as a mobile lab with infusion materials, a centrifuge, freezers, and computers to transmit data. The team quickly turned Heartland's large dining room, which was not being used because the pandemic had put a stop to communal dining, into an infusion center. The day after the medical team arrived, the first residents and staff who agreed to participate received infusions. Participants are randomly assigned to receive one of two infusions, a placebo or the monoclonal antibody, designed to latch onto the virus and to block it from entering and infecting cells. At Heartland, 25 of the 80 residents who were approached eventually agreed to join the trial. The drug should remain in the participants' bodies for at least a month, and possibly as long as 3 months, the researchers say. Participants and doctors do not know who is getting the antibody and who is not. It's a little daunting from the patient's standpoint, said Dr. Mark Gloth, chief medical officer at ProMedica Senior Care, HCR Manor Care, a nationwide chain of 222 nursing homes and long-term care facilities, including Heartland. We have been restricting visitors for months. Some family members say, I can't even get in there and hold my loved one's hand. I want to be sure it's okay with them. Lee Rowland, 45, was in the nursing home recovering from a serious pressure sore when he was asked if he wanted to join the study. He readily agreed. A paraplegic since falling from a fire escape when he was 22, Mr. Rowland was unable to leave his room because he cannot sit in his wheelchair. So the investigators came to him. The infusion took an hour. For the next 2 hours, the team monitored Mr. Rowland's vital signs, heart rate, blood pressure, blood oxygen levels. Because he cannot easily travel to a lab for subsequent tests, investigators plan to visit his home once he leaves Heartland. He's worried, of course. If he got the drug, it might cause adverse reactions. But somebody has to go first, Mr. Rowland said. The study is being undertaken at nursing homes and extended care facilities across the United States and will enroll 2,400 residents and staff. Eli Lilly hopes to enlist 500 facilities. So far, about 125 have agreed to join the study, and the company anticipates enrolling 40 to 80 participants at each site. There are obvious advantages to testing the drug in nursing homes. Residents are all in one place, making it easy to do contact tracing. And the rocket pace of a nursing home outbreak makes it easier to see if the coronavirus can be halted with this drug. Monoclonal antibodies are difficult to make. The drug, if it works, is expected to be expensive. An infusion of a monoclonal antibody can cost thousands of dollars. Eli Lilly has not announced what it will charge for the drug if it is approved for marketing. There is no guarantee of success, and previous attempts to do studies in nursing homes have fallen short. Nursing home residents can be difficult participants. Many have dementia or have difficulty seeing and hearing. Yet they, or in some cases, someone designated to make decisions for them, must provide informed consent. Informed consent is very scripted and can be incredibly challenging, especially with an infused experimental drug, Dr. Boxer said. Potential participants have to read and understand a form that explains the risks and the adverse side effects that can occur. Then, she said, participants usually have to repeat back in their own words what they are being asked to do. The people soliciting informed consent most often are not nursing home staff, since they have to be credentialed by an ethics board that approved the study. Yet they need to understand the limitations of working with the very old and disabled, Dr. Boxer said. Often, residents will want someone else to sign the consent form for them, but states have varying regulations governing who may be authorized. Some residents with dementia might agree one day, but forget the next that they agreed to take part and then reverse their decision. Nursing homes are very protective of patient privacy, but research regulations allow investigators, in some circumstances, to review patients' medical records to identify patients who might be eligible for a study. There just isn't a culture in nursing homes that is attuned to doing research in clinical trials, said Dr. Matthew Wania, director of the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at the University of Colorado. When Dr. Cohen, who is working with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases to run clinical trials of antibodies, thought of the nursing home trial, he began calling chief executives of nursing home chains. At the end of the calls, I was really shaken up, he said. They explained the unbelievable suffering of clients and families. Residents who were infected were dying alone. No visitors allowed, he learned. Staff members were falling ill. Nursing home executives were eager to participate in the study. In Citrus Heights, California, a staff member at a nursing home tested positive earlier this month. The moving van and RV appeared the next day, and Katie Tenner, 37, a staff dietitian, was among those who volunteered for the study. The infusion and monitoring took so long, she had to get the treatment on her day off. Every day for the next 56 days, she has to have her vital signs checked. Every week, she has to have a coronavirus test. But she is excited about the study. So often, she said, she drives home from work, listening to news on the radio, and bawling my eyes out, hearing about my fellow healthcare workers dying from this virus. This could be a weapon to fight it and maybe outsmart it, she said. This month, students across the country will be performing an annual fall ritual, and that is leaving their homes for schools. Here's an NPR report about Move-In Day this year. Coronavirus reshapes the college experience.
The University of North Carolina announced yesterday that it was backing away from its plans to hold classes in person just 1 week into the fall semester. This has been the concern all summer long. The colleges would welcome students to campus, and then they'd have to shut down right away. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny has been covering this. She is in Georgia this week, where students at that state's flagship university are moving onto campus. Hi, Alyssa.
Hey, good morning.
Before we get to Georgia, where you are, let's start with UNC Chapel Hill. Tell us what happened there.
So after just a week of classes, UNC Chapel Hill, one of the larger campuses trying to bring folks back for in-person classes, reversed the decision. So they're now pivoting to all remote instruction following several coronavirus clusters on campus.
Clusters. So what exactly are we talking about? How many students are impacted here?
Well, according to the university, just last week, 130 students and 5 employees tested positive. The clusters are in housing, both on and off campus. The school says it's going to work to reduce on-campus housing. It's going to let students out of those contracts without penalty. I've been keeping in touch with a junior at UNC, Maida Devarajan. She's just moved into her off-campus apartment over the weekend. Here's what she had to say.
People saw this coming. This was not by any means a surprise for a lot of faculty members, campus workers, students. I was not even here for 24 hours, and then classes ended up being shifted.
All over the country, colleges are watching what's happening at UNC as they themselves are starting to bring students back.
Wow, people saw this coming, she said. I mean, that's amazing. This has to be on the minds of universities that are going through the reopening process, and one of them is the University of Georgia, where you are. What's it feel like there?
Well, we got to campus on move-in weekend, which usually is a pretty rowdy weekend, but here it's relatively quiet. You know, there's just groups of students hanging out on campus. The campus does require masks pretty much all the time when you're not eating or in your dorm, and students have been complying. We saw students outside a fraternity house playing basketball. All but one were wearing masks.
Wow. Well, how do you even handle a move-in in a state like Georgia, which has had, I think, the highest number of positive cases per population in the country, right?
That's right. There are special COVID procedures here to slim down spaces, to keep less crowded. You know, you had to sign up for slots to move in. You're only allowed to bring 2 people into the dorm with you. And we saw tons of cleaning supplies.
We provided her with hand sanitizers, masks, disinfectants for her room.
That's mom Ebony Coleman, whose daughter Kindle is starting her freshman year. She packed a quarantine bag with her to move in.
Just like a first aid kit, if you will. She's got a duffel bag that we put together with extra chargers, a few shelvable rations, if you will, chicken broth, whatever we could put in there just to make sure that she had what she needed in quarantine.
So that's just in case she gets sick. You know, there's a little anxiety, of course. This is a different kind of move-in, but it's also really exciting, and the Coleman family is really proud.
UGA has been her dream school for years, since she was a little girl. I'm feeling emotional. Haven't cried yet, but I probably will.
Oh, I'm getting chills listening to such a proud mom. I mean, it. How are students feeling? I mean, can they focus on the beginning of this college experience with everything going on in quarantine bags?
So, for the most part, they're really happy to be on campus. We talked to a group of students who were eating dinner outside by the football stadium.
It was really good that we were able to get on campus so they can see what tactics are working, what's not, even though we have to be, like, the sacrificial lambs.
And it kind of makes me nervous because, like, I probably already walked past somebody who has it and doesn't even know it.
That was Jana Muhammad and Annette Carmago-Vera, first-year students. They had masks. The college actually sent every student 2 washable masks and a thermometer in the mail before they came to campus. Right now, they're more concerned with making friends and actually recognizing people on campus in those masks than getting coronavirus themselves.
Well, I mean, Elizabeth, what we saw at UNC, they decided there were enough clusters, enough concern that they had to go online. I mean, does Georgia have a threshold for when they would need to shut down and when things would get bad enough?
So I put that question to Dr. Shelley Nuss, who's been helping implement reopening plans here.
That's the million-dollar question, Alyssa. I mean, of course, it's been discussed, but it's very complicated. Are we out of our own isolation beds? You know, how many pockets are in dorms versus not? I mean, there's probably 20 or 30 different things.
So not a concrete answer. You know, UGA is doing randomized testing every day on campus. Nuss says they're planning on reporting the number of positive cases on a weekly basis. But the big question here is, what do students do off campus? You know, we did go out last night, and the bar strip in downtown Athens was full of students, many without masks. On the street, there were reunions, hugs, chatting, smoking. One thing to note, you know, it's warm out here, so there is a lot of socializing that's happening outside.
All right. Alyssa, I know you're going to be traveling over the next several months on the road exploring what college looks like in a pandemic. If you are a college student or professor, you want to share your experience, you can find Alyssa on Twitter at Alyssa Nadworny. Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Now here's a story that was published by CNN on Wednesday. Here's what happened when students went to school during the 1918 pandemic. This isn't the first time leaders have struggled with deciding whether to keep schools open in a pandemic. During the influenza pandemic in 1918, even though the world was a very different place, the discussion was just as heated. That pandemic killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide, including 675,000 Americans, before it was all over, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. While the vast majorities of cities closed their schools, 3 opted to keep them open: New York, Chicago, and New Haven, according to historians. The decisions of health officials in those cities was based largely on the hypothesis of public health officials that students were safer and better off at school. It was, after all, the height of the Progressive Era, with its emphasis on hygiene in schools and more nurses for each student than is thinkable now. New York had almost 1 million school children in 1918, and about 75% of them lived in tenements in crowded, often unsanitary conditions, according to a 2010 article in Public Health Reports, the official journal of the U.S. Surgeon General and U.S. Public Health Service. For students from the tenement districts, schools offered a clean, well-ventilated environment where teachers, nurses, and doctors already practiced and documented thorough, routine medical inspections, according to the Public Health Reports article. The city was one of the hardest and earliest hit by the flu, said Dr. Howard Markle, a medical historian and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. He was a co-author of the 2010 Public Health Reports article. Children leave their often unsanitary homes for large, clean, airy school buildings where there is always a system of inspection and examination enforced, New York's health commissioner at the time, Dr. Royal S. Copeland, told the New York Times after the pandemic had peaked there. Students weren't allowed to gather outside school and had to report to their teacher immediately, according to Copeland. Teachers checked students for any signs of the flu and students who had symptoms were isolated. If students had a fever, someone from the health department would take them home, and the health official would judge whether the conditions were suitable for isolation and care, according to public health reports. If not, they were sent to a hospital. The health department required families of the children recovering at home to either have a family physician or use the services of a public health doctor at no charge, the public health report article said. The argument in Chicago for leaving schools open for its 500,000 students was the same. Keeping schools open would keep the children off the streets and away from infected adults, the reasoning went. If social distancing was helpful then, it would have been made easier by the fact that absenteeism in schools soared during the pandemic, perhaps because of what one Chicago public health official called flu phobia among parents. The absentee rate was so great, it really didn't matter that schools were open, Markle said. Part of Chicago's strategy was to ensure that fresh air was circulated. Schoolrooms were overheated during the winter so that windows could remain open at all times, according to a 1918 paper by the Chicago Department of Health. The paper concluded that an analysis of data showed that the decision of keeping the schools of this city open during the recent influenza epidemic was justified. And in New York, then Health Commissioner Copeland told the New York Times how much better it has been to have the children under the constant observation of qualified persons than to close the schools. Merkel, who with other researchers pored over data and historical records in looking at the response of 43 cities to the 1918 pandemic, isn't as convinced. New York didn't do the worst, but it didn't do the best either, Merkel said, adding Chicago was slightly better. Research showed that cities who implemented quarantining and isolation, school closures, and bans on public gatherings fared the best, he said. The cities that did more than one of these measures did better. School closures were part of that contribution, Merkel said. Public health experts, including Merkel, are quick to point out that COVID-19 is not influenza, which was a well-known disease in 1918. There is a lot to learn about the novel coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19. The right decision today, Merkel said, is school closure. It's better, he said, to be safe than sorry. Now to our next pre-recorded report. This is from the Texas Standard, and it's about how Texas teens are offering virtual tutoring and mentorship to healthcare workers' children.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As schools reopen their doors, both virtual and physical, two Texas high schoolers wanted to help doctors and nurses who spend long hours at work away from their kids. So they created TeleMentors, now a growing program that provides educational and emotional support to kids of healthcare and frontline workers. KERA's Alejandra Martinez has this story.
So are you nervous for school, or like, how are you feeling?
I'm a bit nervous because, like, nobody has really done virtual school before ever.
That's 16-year-old Amruth Nandish talking to 10-year-old Jovan Habar. Nandish has been tutoring Habar since June. Habar's mom's a hospital pediatrician in Houston, and the fifth grader is studying for a test to get into private school.
And, you know, I don't like chocolate. Yesterday they got him a...
Nandish is tutoring Habar as part of a program he created called TeleMentors. It matches the children of healthcare workers with high school volunteers who check in, play card games, draw, and tutor.
I just feel like just giving them an outlet to someone to talk to is almost like having like a friend.
Nandish recalls his own summers alone at home. He's a child of a dentist and a civil engineer who work long hours. When the pandemic started, Nandish heard family members, many of whom are medical professionals, talking about what to do with their kids who are home all the time.
They're like, oh my God, my daughter's just watching TV all day. She's literally not doing anything.
Nandish started calling HR departments at hospitals around Houston, offering to help their staff.
First week I matched a couple of people. they said yes, everyone liked it, and it just kind of kept growing from there.
As more people signed up, Nandish brought in a friend from Dallas to help, 17-year-old Southwick Salati.
I really thought that we could add a level of networking towards it, like advertising it through my student life and getting a lot of tutors there.
They set up a website, created a sign-up page, and a guide for volunteers on how to approach each tutoring session.
Okay, so your mom asked me to just go over some basic things. Let me pull up a worksheet for that, okay?
Amrus Nandish pulls up the worksheet during a Zoom call with Habar, shares a screen, and they work together on a math problem.
1/2 × 5/4.
Habar's mother, Shushma, says this program has lifted a weight off her shoulders. All three of her kids take part in Telementors.
Taking something off my plate, it makes it a little less stressful for me. Because during this time, it's stressful for everybody, whether you're frontline or not.
Since May, Telementors has signed up 60 kids in Texas and 4 other states. They've recruited 45 high schoolers who earn community service hours and form connections with younger children.
She loves Peppa Pig, and we love drawing Peppa Pig together. We draw sunsets. We draw plants.
That's 14-year-old Rhea Pawar, who tutors a 3-year-old.
I have to, think of ways to make her focus and want to get her work done, because sometimes she gets a little distracted because a 45-minute class is really long.
And Telementor's co-founder, Southwick Salati, says mentoring doesn't just help the kids.
Overall, it's a testament to how loneliness is something that we take for granted in this time, especially during the coronavirus. So I think that's another thing we try to lessen the effects of loneliness, because I think it really does do a lot of benefit to not only the kids, but also the high school mentors.
Founder Salati and Nandish say they would like to keep Telementors going even after the pandemic ends, but they want to shift their focus and offer their program not just to kids who are at home, but to kids who are stuck in hospitals long term. I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
Now let's move to the economic part of our story. With no end in sight to the shutdown, Texas bar owners and employees are on the brink of losing everything. Holly Jackson spent 20 years working for the Austin nightclub Barbarella, where crowds of customers danced and drank until the early morning hours. But for months, there's been no music or cocktails at Barbarella. And Jackson and around 30 of her employees have been furloughed. "I have no idea what's going to happen to me, honestly," said Jackson, the bar's general manager. "I feel like I've lost my right arm. I have no family. I have no kids, no husband. My entire identity in life was Barbarella, and now that's gone." Governor Greg Abbott has shut down Barbarella, along with the rest of Texas's bars, twice, once in March and again in June, in an attempt to stem the spread of the coronavirus. There is no end in sight for when bars will be allowed to reopen, leaving those business owners and their workers worried about how long they can hang on until they lose everything. In some cases, bar owners are planning to reopen anyway in a desperate attempt to generate some income and draw Abbott's attention. Jackson joins thousands of service industry workers who have filed for unemployment, with restaurant and bar workers leading the state in number of claims, about 12.5% of the 3.2 million unemployment claims filed in Texas between the beginning of March and early August have come from workers in the accommodation and food services sector. But economists say joblessness in Texas will only improve when the state has a handle on the coronavirus and consumers feel like they can safely patronize businesses in person. Still, Texas is experiencing record numbers of deaths related to the coronavirus and high numbers of hospitalizations. While some bars can serve to-go items or reopen as restaurants, both of these options require them to have a permanent kitchen, excluding many bars across the state. Chris Porter, a spokesperson for the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, said about 6,600 active businesses were required to close under the order. Jackson said she feels abandoned by the state and is frustrated by the radio silence from the governor. Abbott addressed the shutdown last week, expressing sympathy for employees put out of work. but he said the closure would need to continue until coronavirus metrics improve significantly, with the state's positivity rate dropping below 10% for a sustained period of time and the number of hospitalizations decreasing. But many bar owners say their businesses might not survive that long. Last month, Elizabeth McNeil was forced to move into an RV along with her husband and 14-year-old son behind Ironwood Saloon in Sabinal. Her husband was the bar's general manager, and now they're relying on her income as a school teacher to scrape by. They've depleted their savings and maxed out credit cards, trying to keep their dream of owning a bar afloat. "I don't want to lose a dream that we've had for years," McNeil said. "But on September 1st, I will have to close these doors for good." The TABC recently allowed some bars and other businesses with high alcohol sales to reopen as restaurants after they applied for food and beverage certificates. However, this workaround requires businesses to have an on-site kitchen and keep alcohol sales under 51%, which excludes many bars across the state and is sometimes cost prohibitive. Kim Finch owns two bars in Dallas, but neither has a kitchen, so she's going all in on a third bar, a lease she signed before the pandemic began that is under construction with a kitchen that will allow it to open as a restaurant. But even once it's open, she doesn't know if it'll be enough to offset her losses. "I have absolutely no way to make any income or revenue to pay all the bills, taxes, rent that are due. I can't provide jobs for my employees," she said. "I have no way to save my business that I've worked 17 years to build, and I'm afraid I'm going to not only lose my businesses, but lose my house." Finch has cashed out all of her investments and her life insurance policy and has depleted 15 years of savings. It's money she won't get back even if her businesses survive. She tried opening a pop-up market but was told that wasn't allowed because even without alcohol, her business was still a bar. "It's disheartening, it's frustrating, it's maddening," she said. "I understand there were bad bar operators too that were not adhering to guidelines, but it sucks for the ones that were really trying hard to be safe." Reopening and protest. Some bar owners say they have no choice but to open in defiance of the state moratorium. Hundreds of bar owners across the state participated in a demonstration late last month called Freedom Fest, intended to prove they could open safely. As a result, 16 bars' liquor licenses were suspended. Chris Pallone, the event's organizer and owner of the Rail Club Live in Fort Worth, said the event adhered to strict safety precautions, limiting capacity to 25%, requiring masks at all times, and enforcing social distancing. And last week, around 100 bar owners gathered to protest near the TABC office. But Pallone said the group hasn't been able to discuss the situation with anyone from the TABC or from Abbott's office. So now, Pallone and some bars are making plans for another unified reopening August 29th, dubbed Come and Take It. "We don't have a choice. Our livelihoods are on the line," he said. "We're opening and we're not closing back down." The hope is that if enough bars reopen, the TABC will be overwhelmed and unable to enforce the shutdown order, Pallone said. Pallone said he will be selling small ownership stakes of his business instead of tickets to his customers, since he says owners of the bars are still allowed to be inside. "We're not selling cover charges," he said. "We're making everybody an owner." A. Bentley Nettles, executive director of the TABC, addressed rumors of bars reopening in an August 7th letter to the industry. "Recently, we have spoken with business owners who tell us they don't intend to follow the orders. On that note, I want to remind every member of this industry that it is a privilege to be in the alcohol beverage business in Texas," Nettles said in the letter. "When a business tells TABC it doesn't intend to follow these orders, You leave the agency with no option but to revoke your license and shut you down. Porter says any business that defies Abbott's order will first face a 30-day suspension of its license to sell alcohol. Second, offenses will result in a 60-day suspension, with third offenses leading to stronger actions up to and including cancellation of the permit. Music venues. The bar shutdown is also hurting Texas musicians and concert venues. About 90% of National Independent Venue Association members report they will close permanently in a few months without federal funding, according to an internal survey. Many bars have doubled as music venues and vice versa. "I haven't had a paying gig since February 11th, Austin drummer Mike Webb said. "Nobody I know has gotten any gigs." Some of his musician friends have moved on to other jobs. One is a janitor now. Another is working at a grocery store. According to the Austin Chamber of Commerce, 83% of the city's live music venues and 70% of the restaurant and bar owners reported in a survey that they had to lay off full-time employees. Most of those businesses indicated that if something doesn't give in the next few months, that they are at risk of closing their doors, said Laura Huffman, CEO of the Austin Chamber. Pallone said the economic efforts of music venues rippled outward, funding musicians, agents, sound engineers, distribution companies, public relations firms, and other businesses. The National Independent Venue Association estimates that for every dollar spent at music venues, $12 is generated in economic activity. "If we lose," he said, referring to venues being forced to close, "music, in my opinion, will never be the same. The local music business will never be the same." Lack of collaboration from Abbott. State Representative Matt Schaefer, Republican Tyler, said closing bars, breweries, and other businesses with high alcohol sales while restaurants are allowed to open is unfair and impractical. "You can go into a restaurant and you can drink. You can buy a $10 hamburger and fries, and you can order three drinks," Schaefer said. "You could sit there and have your drinks and eat your hamburger without a mask. Tell me how that's any different." He said there's been a lack of collaboration among lawmakers with both Abbott and with the TABC. Porter, from TABC, disagreed. "From the beginning of this crisis, TABC has worked closely with stakeholders to assist struggling businesses and at the same time protect the health of Texans," he said. "We've also worked directly with industry members and state lawmakers to find ways of assisting businesses." Schaefer said lawmakers will have to look at options in the upcoming legislative session, which begins in January, to find ways to offer relief to the food and beverage industry. "We've got to find economic relief for this industry when you have livelihoods essentially being destroyed by government order," Schaefer said, adding that it'll be a challenge due to a constricted budget. State Representative Erin Zwiner, Democrat, Driftwood, said she's unsure that indoor dining of any kind is a good idea right now and believes that a lot of the COVID-19 cases that came on the heels of Texas's phased reopening could be tied to restaurant and bar activity. But Zwiner lamented that there has not been enough collaboration between Abbott and lawmakers. Abbott did not respond to requests for comment. "I really wish Abbott would work more closely with legislators, but his circle only seems to get smaller," she said. "Absolutely, legislators are by and large not at the table, and that seems to be a bipartisan frustration." For Jackson, the general manager of Barbarella, the hardest thing to grapple with is that she has no idea what comes next. She's running out of options while waiting for something to change. "I have mentally in my head prepared myself to have to lose my house and probably move back home to Orlando with my mom at 40 years old," she said. "It's scary. I did what I was supposed to do. I went to college and worked my ass off at the same job. Bought a house, and now it's all being taken away for something that I didn't do." And on the heels of that article, we have a recorded report from NPR that relates. In this case, it's not the bar or restaurant business owners or music venues, but it's the people who supply some of the drinks that are served at those places, and particularly French winemakers. Here's the story. COVID-19 pandemic deals blow to French winemakers.
The pandemic may have inspired more at-home drinking, but it has dealt a huge blow to French winemakers. With hotels and restaurants closed for months, wine sales have plummeted. Growers have a glut of unsold product and lack cash for the upcoming grape harvest. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Sandrine d'Auvergne and her husband Olivier quit their jobs in the north of France and moved to Burgundy 4 years ago to realize their dream of making organic wine.
We do it with sincerity and a lot of work. Comment dire reconnaissance. We do our best and the wine are recognized.
They make 6 reds and 4 whites from the Pinot Noir and Chardonnay grapes that run along the Côte de Chalonnay hillsides. She says the wines of their Domaine de la Luole were starting to make a name for themselves when the coronavirus hit.
The border was closed. The café, hôtel, restaurant were closed. People were not allowed to come and buy our wine. So during 2 months, we sold nothing.
But the pandemic wasn't the only blow to French winemakers in the last year. They, along with other European winemakers, became collateral victims in a transatlantic trade war between Airbus and Boeing and were slapped with a 25% tariff.
Well, it's a catastrophe.
That's Sacha Lichine, who makes rosé wine amidst chirping cicadas on his vineyard in Provence.
We had, obviously, the Trump tax, the tariff, and afterwards we had the COVID, and believe it or not, we got frosted here also. So it's a really sort of a complicated moment in time.
The French government has unblocked 250 million euros for its distressed winemakers, aid that includes paying a minimum price for surplus wine to distill into industrial alcohol, something that's never been done in Burgundy, say local vintners. But those hardest hit by the pandemic could be the champagne makers, their beverage so closely linked with good times and festivity. The Lallemand family, makers of champagne Lallemand Pelletier, is enjoying a few days of vacation on the coast before heading back to Champagne to begin the harvest. Sophie Lallemand admits things have been difficult.
COVID put an abrupt stop to the sale of our champagne. We couldn't export or travel, and people weren't hanging out with family and friends, so they weren't drinking it either.
The Champagne Wine Board says sales may have dropped 25% from last year. That's some 75 million bottles. There has been an unexpected effect of the crisis, says winemaker Lichine, whose Whispering Angel brand is among the world's top-selling rosés. What he lost in restaurant and hotel sales, he made up for in retail, especially online. Lichine says more than ever, people want brands they know and trust.
So we really had a brand out there, I think, at a particular price point, which was COVID-proof somehow.
Back in Burgundy, d'Auvergne shows me the rich biodiversity of plant and animal life surrounding her vineyards. She says people realize more than ever that nature is in charge.
A good effect of this pandemic is to connect us with the nature and to know that everything is linked and we have to promote and to taste products who are safe.
D'Auvergne says people have been making wine for 8,000 years, and in the grand scheme of things, the pandemic is just another challenge. Wine is perennial, she says, and I have confidence in the future. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Burgundy.
This is NPR News.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Friday, August 21st, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. We'll bring you USA Today with your national news coming up next. At 3 o'clock, what follows is the local news. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading from the local papers. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Peyton says leeway needed in virus restrictions. Katie Joyner running for MISD District 4. MPD unveils Nathan Hayden Heidelberg Memorial Highway sign. From the Odessa American, ECHD reports 64 active Deering's cases. New juvenile center mauled. ECISD teachers in line for incentive pay. And West Texas Food Bank receives $54,000 donation. Those are some of the articles we'll be reading at 3 o'clock this afternoon. At 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal. And being that it is Friday, at 7 tonight, it's On the Lighter Side, which are readings from humorous publications and writers. So to get away from some of the heavy news that we report during the week, we invite you to listen to The Lighter Side and have a laugh tonight at 7 o'clock. Also on Fridays, it's been our custom to leave you with some kind of a fun song. Today, we're going to celebrate a birthday. On August 17, 1958, Belinda Carlisle, the singer for the Go-Go's, and also her own solo songs, was born. So we're going to leave you with a fun song to set off into the weekend. And we do hope that you have a great weekend. Stay safe, and we'll talk again on Monday. Here's Belinda Carlisle. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3:00.